Morning.
Would you please just state your full name and spell your last name?
Todd Cameron Gray, G-R-E-Y.
What's your profession?
I'm the chief medical examiner for the state of Utah.
Does that mean you're a physician?
Yes.
A licensed physician?
Yes.
What's the specialty of your area of practice in medicine?
I'm a forensic pathologist, which means that I'm a doctor that has been trained in pathology, which is essentially the study of disease. And then I have received subspecialty training in that aspect of pathology involved in the investigation of sudden and unexpected death.
We'll get back to that in just a while. Where are you employed currently?
At the medical examiner's office for the state of Utah. Our office is located on the university campus here in Salt Lake.
What is your position?
I'm the chief medical examiner.
What does that mean?
That means that in addition to working as a forensic pathologist doing exams and handling cases, I'm also the chief administrative officer for the death investigation system we have in Utah.
How long have you been the chief medical examiner?
Since 1988.
Let's start with just your educational background. You get into college and then through your medical education.
I received my undergraduate degree from Yale University in 1976. My medical degree from Dartmouth Medical School in 1980. I was trained in anatomic pathology at the University of California in San Diego, and I did my training in forensic pathology at the Dade County Medical Examiner's Office in Miami, Florida.
Tell us a little about your work experience before you came here to Utah to work on the medical exam.
Okay. In San Diego, I was being trained in general anatomic pathology, so that basically means I was learning how to do autopsies, how to make diagnoses by looking at tissues under the microscope and things like that. Between the San Diego and Miami, I worked in a small hospital in New Mexico as a pathologist, essentially a hospital-based practice where I would look at set specimens that were submitted from surgery. I would look at cytology. I would do autopsies. In Miami is where I was trained as a forensic pathologist, so I started doing cases of sudden unexpected death and investigating those.
Let's talk a little bit more about forensic pathology involves. What does the word forensic mean?
Forensic basically means the intersection of law and science. So a forensic pathologist not only is a physician who knows about things related to sudden death, but also the process of presenting those findings in a court of law.
And are you board certified in forensic pathology?
Yes, I am.
When were you board certified?
I became board certified in 1986.
And tell us what's involved in becoming board certified in forensic pathology.
Okay. Board certification means that a physician has completed an approved course of study, and then has taken and passed an examination in the field which they wish to become certified in.
Are you board certified in other areas of pathology, other types of pathology?
Yes, I'm also board certified in anatomic pathology, and that same process is involved.
Tell us a little more about what anatomic pathology is.
Basically, that means, as I said earlier, the study of disease. An anatomic pathologist is the doctor who will look at tissues, look at organs, and make diagnoses based on what they see.
Any other areas of board certification?
No, those are the two areas.
Tell us about the duties of your position, not the administrative side, but the day-to-day duties of the chief medical examiner as it relates to what your office is.
Okay. Leaving aside the administration, essentially what I do as a medical examiner is when deaths that fall under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner's office are reported, I will be one of the physicians that will be responsible for finding out what happened to that person. And that will entail such things as we may go to a death scene, see what's going on there. We'll read investigative reports, either from investigators from my office or police investigators. We'll do the actual examination of the body and then come to conclusions as to how that person died.
When you said the examination of the body, is that also commonly referred to as an autopsy?
An autopsy is one type of examination we may do, yes.
But the overall goal of what you do is a death investigation.
Yes, find out what happened to that person, how they came to their death.
Do you also supervise other physicians who work for the medical examiner's office?
Yes. Currently, there are five other physicians in the office whose work I will supervise.
As you are involved in that process, do you also consult with those physicians as to the cases where they're the medical examiner?
Yes.
Do you also supervise other staff members, including investigators?
Yes.
Tell us the role of these investigators for the medical examiner.
The investigator basically is involved in getting information that puts a death in context. For example, you can show me someone who has a gunshot wound of the head. Very obvious why that person is dead. We don't know whether that's an accident, whether it's a murder, whether it's a suicide, without some sort of investigative information, put it into context. And then my investigators, in conjunction with law enforcement and others, are the ones that give us that information that help put that death into perspective.
Into context.
Yes.
You mentioned law enforcement investigation is also something you consider?
Of course, yes.
And what other general information do you factor in as you determine the things that you have to answer?
Essentially anything that we feel is relevant. So we will obviously look at medical records, notes from hospitals, entries from private physicians, information from families, friends, anything that helps us understand what was going on and what may have contributed or led to the person's death.
Are you also a member of the State Child Fatality Review Committee?
Yes, I am.
Generally speaking, tell us the function of that group.
That's a group made up of professionals from various disciplines, including the medical examiner's office, pediatricians, attorneys, social workers, all involved in some way or another with child welfare and issues relating to why children die.
And how does that group function? Do they actually review cases involving child death?
Yes. It starts with a review of all death certificates of children. That review is usually done by one or two committee members. They will refer questionable cases or cases which may need more investigation or discussion to the full committee, and then we will meet usually on a monthly basis to go over those kinds of more questionable or problematic deaths.
What questions do you attempt to answer during the death investigation process?
The two most important questions we're trying to answer is what killed this individual and how did that come about? So the two questions are cause of death and then the manner of death.
Tell us a little bit more about what factors into determining cause of death.
Cause of death is that disease, injury, or abnormality that led to death. So this is essentially more of a diagnosis based on looking at a person, doing an examination of the person, seeing what is wrong physically. Manner of death is a classification or characterization of the death as one of five possibilities. It's either a natural death, an accident, a suicide, a homicide, or we do not know, undetermined. And so, in addition to saying what killed them, we have to determine how that came to be, put it into one of those categories.
Within that context, what does the word homicide mean?
Homicide, the medical definition of homicide is the person died as the result of an intentional action by another person.
As you try to answer those questions, do you consider beyond just the medical information that you receive, the other investigative information that you talked about earlier?
Yes. We try to synthesize and utilize all the information we can to come to an accurate conclusion about what happened to the person.
Dr. Gray, can you offer an estimate of the number of death investigations you personally performed over your career?
Personally, last time I looked at my numbers, I'm approaching 12,000.
How many of those death investigations have involved the deaths of children?
On average, I will see probably 30 to 40 child deaths a year. So over a course of a, 26, 27 year career, you can do the multiplication, it's in the hundreds.
Have many of those child death situations involved determining whether the injuries were the result of something someone else did to the child, or an accident, or something?
Yes, child homicides. Again, I probably see three or four a year. Cases where there's an allegation or suspicion that it may be a homicide, more than that, and some of those turn out to be not homicides, and we can disprove the allegation. Some turn out to be homicides.
Have you received, over your career, specialized training in recognizing the cause of injuries and the timing of injuries to young children?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the nature of that training.
Well, that's sort of a key question and issue in any kind of a case, whether it be for a child or an adult. And so my training as a forensic pathologist certainly addresses the question of how do certain injuries happen, what can cause those kinds of injuries, as well as the question of can we say, based on what we're seeing, when those injuries occurred. So it's an ongoing process, both in my original training and in what I do on a daily basis.
How do you update your awareness about child injuries and what causes those injuries?
Obviously, you read. Read medical journals. Read about cases. I will attend training seminars or meetings where those issues and questions are discussed. Those would be the two main ways of keeping up in the field.
Do you also consider, as you do a death investigation involving the death of a child, information concerning the likely onset of symptoms or the type of symptoms the child would have felt after particular injuries happened?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So the process of deciding how long somebody may have survived an injury is one which is, again, sort of central to what I do as a medical examiner. As both just a physician and as well as a pathologist, I am able to say what those injuries may have done to the person in terms of how they would feel, how it may affect their ability to function. Those kinds of issues and questions are certainly ones that we will consider in any case.
Tell us about your professional society memberships.
I'm a member of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. I am a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners. Those are the two main national organizations I belong to.
You talked about the child fatality review. Are you also a member of other committees and other consultantships that you've been involved with?
Yes.
Explain a little bit about that.
In addition to the Child Fatality Review Committee, I'm on the Domestic Violence Fatality Review Committee. Let's see, which else? I've been involved in other more short-lived committees related to death investigation issues, for example. Deaths related to pregnancy or women who die soon after birth, things like that.
Do you sometimes present training for other professionals?
Yes, fairly frequently.
Beginning with other medical professionals, tell us some examples of that.
So I will give seminars and talks to other physicians. Recently, focus has been mostly on issues related to prescription drug deaths. I've been doing a lot of education on that. But I will also give presentations on pathology and forensic pathology in particular, both to physicians, nurses, EMTs, medical students, various allied health groups.
Have you also presented training related to child abuse-related injuries?
Yes.
Just give us a few examples of that.
I've given presentations both to law enforcement concerning child abuse and the kinds of injuries that you can see in child abuse situations. I've also presented to both prosecutors and defense bar attorneys in that area.
Have you published in your field?
Yes.
Just a few examples.
Let's see. I've contributed to a textbook on pathophysiology for nursing students. I've written articles which have been published in peer review journals in a variety of topics in forensic pathology, including issues related to child abuse.
Have you also testified as an expert witness on the cause and manner of death of children in the state of Utah?
Yes.
And in other courts as well?
Yes.
I'd like to talk to you for just a minute about the factors that you look at in determining when a particular person as to whom you're doing a death investigation is likely actually passed away.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. Maybe that's a little complicated. Let me break it down. When you're trying to determine the time of death for a person that you're doing the death investigation, what factors generally do you look at?
Determination of time of death, it's not like TV. There's no such thing as a deathometer that I can come along and put on the person and it tells me exactly how long they've been deaf. The information that we use to try to come to a conclusion includes both physical findings on the body as well as investigative information. Changes that develop after death in the body include such things as stiffening of the body or rigor mortis. There's the settling of blood that gives a red-purple color to dependent areas, which is called livor mortis. You can take the temperature of the body and see how fast It's losing heat. It's called algor mortis. There may be other changes like decomposition, the introduction of insects onto the body, which we'll use as sort of a ruler to say maybe how long that person has been dead. The problem with all of these is they're quite variable on a case-by-case basis, so that best we can say, we can give you an estimate of how long someone has been dead. The most scientifically accurate thing we can say is they're dead sometime between when they were last staying alive and when they were found dead.
So let me have you explain that a little bit more, the history involving the behavior of the decedent. Is important as well?
Yes. Historical information may even trump physical information. So you may have physical changes that point to a certain time of death, but then you have investigative information which contradicts that physical finding. So we have to weigh both of those.
In most cases, are you able to give much more than just that estimate?
No, it's always an estimate.
Is the issue of the exact timing of death usually something that is critical to you as you answer the questions of cause and manner of death?
It may be important whether it is absolutely critical, and I can't come to conclusions without a absolute answer. No.
I'd like to talk generally about the process that results in bruises.
Mm-hmm.
What is a bruise?
A bruise, the medical term for it is contusion. Essentially, it's what's called a blunt force injury. It's the kind of injury that happens when force is applied to a body. With a bruise, the force is usually applied over a wide enough area or with a soft enough object that the skin is not broken, but the underlying tissues are crushed, and so blood begins to leak out, and you eventually get the development of a very distinct dark red purple color of the skin where that force has been applied.
Assuming the person is conscious when a bruise is actually caused, trauma is inflicted,
the cause
of bruise. Is it painful? Yes. Do you have ways during an autopsy process to determine whether what appears to be a bruise on the external surface of the body is actually a bruise or something else?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
If I see something that looks like a bruise, first thing I have to decide is that really bleeding or an hemorrhage under the skin? So what I will do is I will make an incision and see what's going on in the deeper tissues. If I see bleeding and hemorrhage, that supports the conclusion that this is indeed a bruise. I may also look at that area of injury under the microscope and see what I can see that way, which can help confirm my initial naked eye opinion or impression.
Just a couple more questions about bruises in general. When you see bruises on, especially a child's body, that appear to be related to some type of pattern, how significant is that to you?
The patterning of bruises, whether it's on a child or anyone, is important because it can give you an idea as to how that injury came to be. If you see, say, a very distinct pattern of a square with a line across it, you might say, oh, look, that's a belt buckle. So patterned injuries are very useful to us because it tells us something about how that injury may have come to be.
Dr. Gray, did you conduct a death investigation on 7-year-old Sun Moon?
Yes.
April 2nd, 2000?
Yes.
What time did the autopsy begin on the 2nd?
We started the examination of this little girl on the 2nd of April, 2008, at 8:10 in the morning.
Who was present during the autopsy?
In addition to myself and assistants from my office, we had Chris Francis and Damon Byington from South Salt Lake PD in attendance. There was also Stephen Pickens from the FBI.
Were photographs taken during the autopsy?
Yes.
Who took the actual photographs?
Those would have been taken by either me or one of my assistants under my direction.
So you would have directed the person as to what?
I would have said, ooh, we got to see that. We got to get a good picture of that. And I would look at the pictures, and if it didn't do what I wanted, I'd say, let's take this one again.
And have you reviewed those photographs that were taken at the autopsy prior to your testimony?
Yes.
What basic information were you provided as to the circumstances of the search for and the discovery of Sununu's body?
Before starting my examination, I had my investigator's report that essentially said this little girl had gone missing on the afternoon of the 31st of March. She had been reported missing early in the evening of the 31st, and a very extensive search had been undertaken, and she was found the next day in an apartment near her own residence or domicile.
As part of your process, were you able to review any photographs of the crime scene or the location where the body was?
Yes.
Were you also provided information by your investigator, Brent Marchand?
Yes, that's what I was referring to.
And was all of that information helpful to you in forming your expert opinions as to cause and manner of Sununu's death?
It certainly played a role in my deliberations and determination, yes.
Did you personally visit the crime scene in this case?
Not that I recall.
If Mr. Martian's report states that you were there, is that likely an error? Or
it's probably a clerical error, because I really have no independent recollection. I have no recollection of going to the scene. Is it possible I did so, and I can't separate pictures from memory? I don't know.
And I'll just relate to you that Mr. Marchand couldn't remember either.
Okay.
His report, but he couldn't remember.
I think it was somebody clicked the wrong box in the computer.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that the fact that Sununu was missing was reported to the police late in the day on March 31st.
That's what I was told, yes.
Did you have any other information as to when she was last seen alive?
The information I was given through my investigator's report was that she was last seen alive sometime around 2:15 p.m. on the 31st.
What was her reported age at the time of her death?
7.
Was that consistent medically with what you found concerning her age?
Yes.
What was her weight and height at the time of the autopsy?
Her weight was recorded as 23 kilograms, so that's about 50 and a half pounds. Her height was 118 centimeters, so we're talking 46 and a half inches, just under 4 feet. Compared to other children, she was average for her age in terms of height and weight.
Based on everything you reviewed, were you able to make a general estimation of when Sununu had passed away?
Specifically, I did not say I think it was X, Y, or Z in terms of a particular time. The report that I was given, again, indicated that when she was examined by my investigator at the scene on the 1st in the evening, she had fully developed rigor and fully developed lividity. That would put her death probably at least 12 hours out from that, and possibly more.
So 12 hours going backward in time?
Yes.
Did you have other information about her behavior during the day before she was last seen?
Essentially, that the information I was given is that she was outside with her brother. They'd had some sort of an argument, and she decided she didn't want to be with him anymore and went away. And that was the last time she was known to be alive by her family or a member of her family.
As you looked at the issue of when she actually passed away, did you find anything inconsistent with her death having occurred between 1 p.m. and 4 to 5 p.m. on the 31st?
No, nothing that I saw would say that's unlikely or impossible.
So tell us generally about the death investigation process, and specifically the autopsy that you did.
So when we do an autopsy or an examination, the first step is look just at the outside of the body. And that will include looking at the person's clothing, seeing if it has any evidence of injury or blood stains on it. We will collect any evidentiary materials that we can see on the outside of the body. We will photograph everything that we see. We will then undress the body and again complete a careful external examination and begin documenting and detailing any evidence of injury, disease, or other abnormality. There may be further evidence collection at that point. We will then do an internal examination where we open the body and individually examine the organs with the same goal in mind, documenting any signs of injury, disease, or other abnormality. We will also collect specimens for toxicology or other laboratory analysis during that process.
Did you find injuries that Sumi would have suffered?
Yes, I found multiple injuries.
Would you just generally tell us the categories of those injuries, and then we'll go back individually and deal with them?
The majority of the injuries that I found were what we call blunt force injuries. So they would be things like contusions or bruises, abrasions or scrapes, lacerations or tears in the skin, as well as a fracture, and in this case fractures of the distal left arm.
Based on all the information you reviewed, is there sufficient information for you to answer the questions that you need to answer about cause and manner of death?
Upon the completion of all of my work, yes.
Okay, we'll get back to that later. What I'd like to ask you now is, did you find any indication that there was a natural or disease cause of Sunamo's death?
I found nothing that would explain her death related to a natural disease process, no.
Was there any indication of a metabolic abnormality, some type of malformation of her internal organs or something of that nature that related to her death?
No, there was nothing endogenously wrong with this little girl. She died as a result of injuries.
And you mentioned toxicology earlier. Was there any indication of any toxic substances that caused your concern?
No.
You mentioned that as you began your autopsy, one of the first things you would do is to look at the clothing that the child is wearing.
That's correct.
Let me ask you just generally, without going into great detail, how was she received by you for the autopsy? What was the situation?
She was received clad in a jacket, shirt, and skirt, which had both evidence of blood staining, and with this jacket was also wet.
I'm sure you have previously marked as State's Exhibits 6 and 7. And ask you what's depicted in these photographs.
These are copies of photographs taken at the time of examination at my office of clothing that the little girl was wearing. Six shows her top, and seven shows her top, her skirt, and her jacket.
So what is shown in this particular photo?
That's her shirt.
That's her shirt. Okay. So going back to this exhibit.
To the left of the screen is her shirt. In the middle is her skirt. And on the right is her jacket.
And, Your Honor, if this hasn't been offered, we'll offer it at this point. Exhibit 6 is
been admitted by stipulation.
I'd like to now show you what are marked as State's Exhibits 8 through 30. And without going through and telling us what each one is, I'd just like to ask if these are all accurate copies of the photographs that were taken during the autopsy process, with the exception of Exhibit 8, which was provided to you.
Yes.
And again, Your Honor, these have been stipulated for identification purposes.
Correct.
Dr. Gray, did you participate in the creation of a computer graphic presentation that includes those exhibits along with a three-dimensional model that you could use to illustrate both your external and internal findings relating to something?
Yes, I did.
Have you reviewed that prior to your testimony?
Yes.
And did you approve the content of this presentation? And were you involved in the creation of it as it was made?
Yes.
Is this an effective way for you to illustrate the internal injuries that Sunu suffered without using autopsy photos of the actual organs of the body?
Yes, I found it a accurate and reasonable depiction of things that could not be otherwise shown.
would using this presentation assist you to both illustrate your medical findings as to injuries and to explain your opinions as to the cause of many of those injuries to someone?
Yes.
You may not have been in the rights.
Parrish, is this sufficient light-wise for you?
No,
go
to
the dark.
Oh.
Or I think this is hard.
Can we just try a couple? Hand you the remote, something I've never done before. Hate to do it at home, but I think it'll make this go a little bit easier. If you could advance to the first slide and tell us the significance of State's Exhibit A, which is a close-up of a photograph that we've been seeing in this trial.
So my understanding is this is a picture of Victor. I don't know exactly when it was taken, but it certainly was close to her age at the time.
Yeah. We probably should have you.
Right. Can you hear it? Okay.
Closer
to the mic. That'll help. So, if I were to tell you that we've had evidence in this case that this photograph was taken potentially a day before the 31st of March, but while she was still living. Does that assist you?
Yes. So this shows what she looks like when she was alive, very close to before her time of death.
And that's something helpful to you?
I think when you see what she looks like after death, it...
Nothing from this point on.
The torso, as we saw her after she was undressed.
And what's significant overall as you look at this photo?
A number of things. First, you can see that her face is swollen and discolored, particularly over the left side of her jaw and chin. She also has bruising over the central chest. You can see over her lower chest and abdomen what's called livor mortis, or the settling of blood after death. So that's not bruising, that's just a change after death. The other striking finding is the deformity and swelling of her left lower arm.
You mentioned livor mortis or lividity earlier. Can you explain just a little bit more what you determined in terms of the likely position that she was in when she passed away?
So lividity basically is a gravitational function, or essentially large bags of juice. and our heart keeps our blood moving through our bodies. After we die, those fluids, particularly the blood, will settle with gravity, and that settling of the blood will lead to a red, usually a red-purple color to the skin on the downwards side. So if you see lividity on the front of the body, that means the person has been lying face down for some period of time after they died.
And if you could just point out a few of the areas here that are that.
Are what?
That are lividity.
Oh, okay. So all of this is lividity. You can also see a little bit of lividity on her arm. This darker area is actually bruising. This is bruising. The left wrist area is bruising, not lividity.
At the left elbow area appears to be a reddened area. Is that lividity?
This
yes.
is lividity.
Okay, so that's what we're referring to as lividity.
That's correct.
Would you advance then to States Exhibit 10? Just in case you need it, here's a laser pointer, but I think as we go along, it's the most probably
okay.
What is shown in States Exhibit 10?
This again is a photograph taken at the time of examination, and this just depicts her face.
Moving on to States Exhibit 11.
This is a photograph again taken at the time of examination, and in this photograph we're looking essentially from below and up onto her right neck, jaw, and cheek.
And what was significant to you in this view?
It's a way of showing injuries that are involved or are present on both her cheek, her chin, and her neck.
And if you would advance again, and just tell us what this circle.
So the oval is highlighting a linear or line-like bruise on her right cheek.
Was that confirmed by you to be a bruise?
Yes.
And is it one bruise or is it a pair of bruises?
It could be a single bruise from a fairly narrow implement or edge striking of the skin. It could be two if there was a paired pattern of surfaces striking there. I can't tell you the difference.
You explained earlier how you verify that things are bruises. Was this one verified?
Yes.
Can you say, and we'll ask this throughout the injuries, that this was something inflicted before she passed away?
Yes.
Explain that process.
Generally speaking, to get a bruise to show up, blood has to be pumped out of the damaged blood vessels and into the crushed tissues. You can occasionally have a phenomenon called postmortem bruising. If you smack a dead body, you may crush the tissues enough so that blood leaks into it. Generally speaking, though, those are rare. The extent of discoloration is much lower. To me, this had the appearance of a fresh antemortem or before death bruise.
If you would advance the slide, then. What is shown on States Exhibit number 12?
Again, a photograph taken at the time of the examination, and we're now looking at the left temple, left eye region. And what it's showing is a laceration or tear, break in the skin, with surrounding scraping or abrasion and bruising or contusion.
Let me ask, based on your entire evaluation of the external surfaces of Propaedi, were there any other areas that would have been actively bleeding besides this particular injury?
No, this was the only injury or defect in the skin that would have could have caused active bleeding.
When it was inflicted?
Yes.
And were you able to form an opinion as to what would likely have caused this injury?
Not per se. What I can say is that something, the skin came in contact with something that was probably narrow enough, sharp enough so that the skin was actually torn. I can tell you the direction that the injury, the force was applied, but the specific implement I cannot determine.
Is this a blunt force tear, or is this a laceration by something sharp, or can you tell the difference?
I cannot really tell how. I mean, it is a laceration, which is by definition blunt force. It's not a stab wound. It does not have the appearance or features of having been made with a sharp implement like a knife or something.
Would you then advance the slide and show us the direction from which the blow was?
So the arrow is pointing the direction that the force came in. So the force was coming like this. Now that could happen because something impacted that way, or the head moved back onto something. I cannot tell you that difference.
Was this, Dr. Gray, a pre-mortem injury?
Yes.
Explain.
Again, this injury had fairly extensive surrounding underlying hemorrhage consistent with the person having blood pressure at the time the injury was inflicted.
If you reviewed photographs of the crime scene, the place where Sunamu's body was found, did you note that there were blood spatters and other areas of blood on the carpet and various other places in that area?
Yes, there was documentation of blood prints or spatter in different parts of the apartment.
Assuming that this is the only injury to her external body that would have been actively bleeding and that there's a relationship to those areas of blood, would that assist you with your opinion that this was a pre-mortem injury?
Yes.
After this was caused, what would she have felt?
That would hurt. That's a cut. It's a tear in the skin. There was crushing of the underlying tissues. Would have been a painful injury.
If we could then move on to State's Exhibit 13.
This is an extreme close-up photograph of, I believe, her left eye. And what we're doing is we're peeling down the eyelid, and we're showing that there are these very fine pinpoint hemorrhages called petechiae on the inner lining of her eyelid, or what's called the conjunctiva.
Could you show us where those are? And explain the process that actually results in those.
The petechiae, or these pinpoint hemorrhages, particularly when you see them on either the lining of the eyelids or the whites of the eyes, are very commonly associated with asphyxia, meaning a cutting off of blood flow to and from the brain.
And would you move on then to exhibit number 14? What are we seeing here?
This is again another close-up photograph of the eye. And in this case, we're seeing those pinpoint hemorrhages on the white of her eye, or the sclera.
Given the, would you just show us where it is that you're seeing those hemorrhages? So it's the dots towards the bottom of the screen.
That's correct.
And this is on the white of her eye, or the sclera?
That is correct.
You mentioned, as you were explaining the injury to the eyelid, that when you see this and the injury you saw to the eyelid, it's often from asphyxia. What's your opinion as to what caused this?
In this situation, further findings in her neck would indicate that there was some degree of strangulation or choking that probably is associated with these injuries.
Are these pre-mortem injuries in States Exhibit 13 and 14?
Yes.
Explain that.
These, again, indicate that vessels have had blood pressure in them and leaked because of the damage from cutting off of the blood flow for a period of time before reestablishment. And that's very common in a strangulation event. You don't just cut everything off and keep it off all the time. It's usually a struggle. There will be some pressure release, TPI are very common in that kind of a situation.
Physiologically, what is it that actually causes these ruptured blood vessels?
It's the lack of blood flow and the damage from a lack of blood flow to the lining of these blood vessels, so that when blood pressure is reestablished or flow is reestablished, they leak.
If we could move on to the next slide, then. What is shown in this photograph?
This is, again, a very close-up photograph taken at the time of examination. And what we are doing here is we've pulled the lower lip down and showing an area of bruising or contusion of the lower lip.
Is it simply bruising, or is there also...
There's a slight disruption or slight tear in the tissue. It would be a very, very small laceration, but it's mostly bruising.
In your opinion, what's the likely mechanism of an injury like this?
This is, again, a blunt force injury, meaning that force has somehow been applied. It certainly could have been applied externally and crushed the lip up against the gum.
Is this in the general area of the bruising along her left cheek and the swelling that you showed earlier?
Yes, generally.
In your opinion, is it likely that she may have bled from this injury into her neck?
No, not significantly.
And can you say that this occurred prior to her death?
It's again consistent with a perimortem or premortem injury.
If we could move on then to States Exhibit 16. Tell us what we're looking at here.
This is a photograph taken at examination showing the front of her neck, her chin, and the left side of her jaw. What we're seeing is a very large, confluent area of bruising involving her cheek and chin. And then on the front of her neck, you're seeing irregular bruising and even some small scrapes over the entire front of the neck.
Let's start with the injuries to the chin, and I'll ask you what you believe caused those.
The area circled, as I said, is a very large, confluent area of contusion or bruising. This is, again, blunt force injury, meaning some sort of an impact over that area of the face. Specifically, whether I can say that was caused by a fist, an open hand, being slammed against something, I cannot say, but some sort of impact in that area.
What type of force would be required with this degree of bruising and swelling?
That's a pretty significant blow, and one of the things that was associated with it is that her jaw was much more loose and mobile than normal. It wasn't actually broken, but it certainly had the joint to the skull stretched and pulled by that blow.
When you look at the bruising and the mobility of the jaw together, does that help you to say what type of blow or blows would have been involved?
Not specifically, but that it was a significant amount of force. That takes a lot to do to get a jaw loosened like that.
Have you seen this type of collection of injuries in others that you've done autopsies?
Have I seen large bruises on the face with jaw instability? Yes, I have. In a variety of situations where people have had major impacts, so people falling great heights, people involved in traffic accidents, those kinds of situations, I've seen that pattern of injury.
And does it tend to be a fairly massive blow that was involved?
A very severe infliction of force in that area.
Is this premortem?
Yes.
What would she have likely felt after just this area, the bruising and the swelling to her jaw and chin area?
Again, I don't have to object with regard to speculation. These questions about pain that she may have felt are contingent on consciousness. We don't know if she was conscious or not. So my objection is speculative.
So let it overrule.
If she was conscious, this would be a painful injury.
Now, if we could move on to the next circle, which is showing the neck injuries. Focus a little bit more on those and what was significant to you.
So these have been
blood force injuries, pressure or impact of some kind has occurred
over this area. One of the things that is very interesting about these is they do have a pattern to them. You can see a very distinct vertical lining kind of a pattern on the lower portion, more of a sort of honeycomb or weave pattern towards the top.
What was the significance of those patterns to you as you consider what caused these?
Looking at that pattern, it appeared to me to be consistent with the cloth from her shirt, the material of her shirt, actually having been pushed up against there or constricting that area, leading to a patterned bruise over the front of her neck.
And we'll get back to this later, but were there internal injuries in this general area of the neck that were significant to your opinion of what caused these?
Yes.
Tell us briefly what those are, what the findings were, and then we'll come back to that. But when you put all of that together, what was your opinion as to what likely caused this?
So, internally, I found damage to the musculature of the neck, particularly over on the left side. The fact of this patterned injury on the outside, deeper injury internally, the petechiae on the sclera and conjunctiva, all in my mind pointed to probably clothing being twisted tightly across the front of her neck, leading to some degree of strangulation and asphyxia.
We move on then to State's exhibit number